the student with a method of learning that integrates work experience and classroom instruction. To find out more about co-op programs at HFCC, go to hfcc.edu/COOP or call 1-800-585-HFCC.
We here at WHFR know you must like style, because after all, you're listening to a radio station that plays many different styles of music. But if you want to take your style up a notch and help us out at the same time, you should check out our online store. Full of t-shirts, sweatshirts, hats, and much more, you can be sure to be looking your best when you're wearing our stuff. Best of all, part of every purchase helps us continue our style of bringing you the best non-commercial music programming around. So check us out today by logging on to www.whfr.fm and click the link on the right of the page for our online store. Once again, our website address is www.whfr.fm. And thank you for helping WHFR continue making waves.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views of the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Mr. Philip Imbrogno. Mr. Imbrogno has been investigating and researching paranormal phenomena for more than 30 years. He has a B.A. degree in astronomy, a B.S. degree in earth science, and a master's degree in chemistry from MIT. He has been a science educator for the past 25 years and has authored countless magazine articles on science and the paranormal, and has appeared on a number of major television presentations on UFOs, astronomy, and the paranormal. He is the author of several books, among them Night Siege, the Hudson Valley UFO Sightings, Interdimensional Universe, and his latest book, Files from the Edge, a paranormal investigator's exploration into high strangeness. So, welcome to the show, Mr. Imbrogno.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you for inviting me.
I appreciate you coming on with us. You were the guest on this show in 2006, as I was talking to you about that before we came on the air. We talked about your book at that time, Night Siege, and Interdimensional Universe, if you recall. And I read your new book, Files from the Edge, and found it quite intriguing. Please tell our listeners about your new book.
Yeah, well, you know, Files from the Edge came out in April, and it's a accumulation of cases that were considered to be high strangeness. In other words, cases so bizarre that most UFO investigators or researchers won't touch them. And, well, you know, while investigating UFOs, and primarily for a great number of years, you know, I was known as, you know, someone who gets out there and researches the UFO phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anybody who's involved with that stuff is going to pick up cases that are so bizarre because, you know, most people who have cases that are, like, UFO-related, but it's very strange, they really don't know who to call. So they call somebody who's involved with UFOs. So if you consider, UFOs are part of paranormal phenomena.
Right.
A big part of paranormal phenomena. So Files from the Edge is more or less those cases that involve some type of contact with otherworldly beings of some sort and creatures that are beyond this reality. So these are cases that I've investigated and accumulated for a number of years, and a couple of them, you know, are my investigations of the phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, involving the UFO stuff is that, you know, I want to mention that I have a book coming out in December.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's called Ultra-Terrestrial Contacts, and it basically focuses on my investigations of people who claim to be in contact with a non-human intelligence, whether they be aliens, whether they be any kind of spiritual channeling, or, you know, and it's an in-depth involved investigation. That's coming out in December. So you're kind of interested to see how that's going to be accepted in the UFO field, because a lot of the views are, once again, cases that so-called respectable UFO investigators won't touch.
Well, you know, when the UFO phenomenon first reared its ugly head, so to speak, even reputable organizations like MUFON did not want to touch the alien abduction cases because they felt that people would not accept that. That was just too far out, too much high strangeness, you know. And now it's just part of the UFO phenomenon.
Yes, well, you know, as you go on, back in the 70s, I remember those days quite well, in the early 80s.
Hmm.
Yes, you know, it was hard enough for people to accept the idea of people having encounters with UFOs.
Hmm.
And, you know, during the Hudson Valley case, you know, we had abduction cases here, but they were purposely kept out of the book Night Siege at request of Dr. Hynek, because he said, you know, we have to try to keep these sightings respectable and believable. If we talk about these sightings that these people are having of these aliens coming in into their house or seeing aliens under a beam of light and being abducted and so on, He said the media will have a field day with it, and then people will be afraid to come forward with their sightings.
Mm.
So, you know, yeah, back in those days, that was the mentality. But today, of course, more people are having paranormal experiences, so they're more willing to talk about it. And plus, you know, there's a lot of stuff on TV and a lot of magazines that are popping up that are paranormal in nature. So people are not as leery or reluctant to talk about their experiences.
Now, do you feel that it's a matter of folks are having more paranormal experiences, or are they just more apt to come forward with them because so many people have come forward with their accounts?
Well, you know, usually when we see an increase in reports, it's usually because of the media. And whenever there's a popular movie, let's say back in the 80s and the 90s, of UFOs or paranormal phenomena, people go to the movies and watch these things, and they get influenced, and they think they have experiences, and it causes a flood of reports. Now, in 1999, and, you know, going all the way up to 2010, 2000, going this year, What happens is that for a very long time, like in the 90s, paranormal, there was practically no reports. But all of a sudden, people start having these experiences again. And it's not because there was anything on television that's influencing them. You see, they started having experiences because they were having experiences and they were looking for answers. Mm. Now, because of so many people having experiences, the media picked up on it now, and they started with all of these shows that you see that are on many of the different channels now. And there's a lot, and there's a few more coming out, reality paranormal shows. You see, what happened in the old days is that the media influenced the public to believe in this. But now it's reversed. Because of the public having these experiences, they influenced the media to do these shows, because for a while, UFOs and paranormal phenomena was practically dead. You couldn't even get a book published in the 90s on UFOs.
Now the skeptics are going to say, well, it's because of all these TV shows on UFOs and abductions and the paranormal. That's why people think that, you know, they watch these shows and then they imagine they have these sightings or experiences.
Well, you know, that might happen to a certain degree, but once again, they're not looking at the statistics in the long run, because it's the people who influence these shows to go on. Remember, these producers on TV, they really don't care if paranormal phenomena exist. They're looking for one thing, to make money, so they're going to go with the pulse of the public.
Right.
And the pulse of the public is the paranormal and UFOs. Why? Not because people want to believe in it because they're looking at the TV. It's because these people are having experiences, right, and they're looking for answers, and it's getting people interested, because so many people are having these experiences. It's not like, you know, in the 50s and the 60s where you had people like Andy the Mystic Barber and Spaceship Ruthie and all of these people who came around. Today, you're having people from, you know, credible people who, in fact, are having these incredible experiences.
Right.
And it's not the true believer. It's not the kook, the person who wants to get abducted by aliens and the Space Brothers and so on. Mm. These are some of these people, I could say a great number of them, are people who never had an interest in the paranormal before.
Right.
And that interest was piqued for them trying to find more answers because it was triggered off by an experience of some sort that they could not explain.
Yeah, they said that back when the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out, well, people saw this movie, and so they imagined that they're having sightings and being abducted and what have you. But in fact, it was the other way around. That movie was based on actual cases. Now, yes, it was fiction, but it was based, they used actual cases to describe visually what people were seeing and what was happening with people.
Oh, yeah. You know, many of the cases that were in there were taken from J. Allen Hynek's book, The UFO Experience.
Right.
Steven Spielberg took that material, and the entire thing of the Devil's Tower and so on was actually based on the Holloman landing. Back in, really, nobody really knows exactly when it took place. It may have taken place several times. But the whole experience was allegedly, supposedly, based on a real experience that took place.
Tell us about the Holloman landing.
It's a popular movie.
Tell us about the Holloman landing.
Well, you know, nobody's really sure of the date. Was it in the 40s? Was it in the 70s? But, you know, it involved, you know, contact with an extraterrestrial intelligence or an alien intelligence from somewhere and meeting them at a particular place and, you know, landing in the Holloman Air Force Base, you know, which is like on the California line, I believe, somewhere out there. And it's a security area, and they landed and they had an exchange program with these aliens and people, just like in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Mm.
Now, you know, back in 1984, I was actually contacted by a number of producers from the Hollywood area, and some people, they were in contact with people who were in this organization in the government. And we met in New York City because they wanted me to be part of the show.
Mm.
And there were other people there also. And And, you know, they said, well, you know, we're going to release to the world that there's this alien intelligence and that the United States government and the major governments of the world have been in contact with them since 1947.
Who is
going
to release?
And I said, well, how are you going to prove it? Mm. And they said, well, we're going to show the entire film at Holloman Air Force Base, the landing and the contact with aliens, and announce that this is not special effects. This is not Hollywood. Mm. This is a real incident that took place, and they filmed it. And at the and they were going to show it live on TV. It was called, the show was called UFO Cover Up Live. Mm. And at the last moment, I understand that the people who were going to bring the Holloman film, the Holloman landing, backed off and were not going to show it. This left the producers a big vacuum, and they had to fill the hour of live TV, 2 hours, I believe it was, and they had to rechange the entire script, which in fact made the whole UFO thing seem ridiculous and unorganized and so on. Yeah. And Mike Farrell, who was, you know, the star in MASH, was the host of that show, and he was interested in UFOs. Mm. And after that show, he said he would never do another show like that again because it made him look him look foolish too.
All right. Well, who was going to release this? Was the government going to release it?
Well, I don't even know who these people were. I sat with them down at a table and dinner in New York City at a hotel. And I'll tell you, this was back in 1984, the early part of 1984. Mm. And let me tell you, and I'm sure a lot of people have seen the movie The Men in Black.
Yeah.
Well, this, you know, these two guys could have actually fit the bill. I mean, with the dark suits and everything else. And they even identify themselves as Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones. I mean, which is funny as heck. Now, I'm wondering who these people are. And the thing is that they proved exactly who they were because they had folders, and in those folders were jackets, as we used to call it in the military, information about everybody who was sitting there, including me. Information that, you know, you could only get if you were part of some type of surveillance organization.
FBI folders.
Yeah, well, you know, let me tell you. They told me at that time, and we were not going to, you're not supposed to say anything to anybody. You got to keep it to yourself, and then it's going to be announced to the world. When I left that hotel in 1984, I was so, like, you know, enthusiastic up about it. I mean, I was being part of this incredible secret that was going to be released to the world. Then, as time came on. Went on, and we got closer to the actual filming of the show. I didn't hear anything, and I heard that the entire format was changed, and I was dropped from the program, as well as a lot of other reputable UFO researchers and witnesses at the last moment, and the producers were forced to rewrite the entire script without the film and the government agents coming on TV, announcing that this was all real. So, whatever happened there is a mystery to me. Some people say it was done purposely to discredit the UFO phenomena. Some people say that there was a secret organization in the government that fractured, and some of them wanted to come forward with the information, and some of them did not, and the people who did not won the battle.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't know what happened.
Well, don't you think that's the case with, like, the Disclosure Project, where people are that were part of the government, part of the cover-up, are now coming forward and telling what they know?
Well, you know, I have a problem with that because the thing is that, let me tell you, there's such secret stuff going on in the government that involves not only UFOs but paranormal phenomena that... The only information that is being released is the information that the people in charge behind the lines, you know, the smoker, like in the X-Files and these people like that, you know, they're only allowing what they want to be released. Hmm. And I base that on this simple fact. When I was investigating the Hudson Valley sightings, there was a sighting over the Indian Point nuclear reactor. And that's a high security area because it provided power for not only the New York City subways, but also power for a number of government installations, NSA, in the area.
Mm.
Now, that UFO, which was reported to be the size larger than a football field, came over the only working reactor, and the entire plant shut down and security shut down, and the entire incident was documented. I mean, they admitted that they had a UFO sighting because they couldn't deny it. Hmm. But the fact is that I talked to six New York State Power Authority police officers.
Mm-hmm.
These are not rent-a-cops. They all have ex-military training, state police training. These are highly trained individuals. And they were shocked as to what they saw. Now, they were willing to talk with me, but I had to meet them in secret places, like late at night. It was like all cloak and dagger stuff.
Yeah.
But the thing is that sooner or later, their supervisors and the New York Power Authority and the New York and the Regulatory Commission found out that I was talking to these people.
Mm.
And I immediately was approached by threats of going to hearings, being told that I was violating national security, that I could be thrown in jail. They were even calling the school that I work at, saying that I may be brought forward on criminal charges for violating national security.
Gee.
Let me tell you, a lot of other things happened with it, with that particular case that had a very bad effect. And the fact is I just touched on something of national security that involved UFOs. And let me tell you, immediately, I got my ears pinned back.
Wow.
So when these people come forward and say they have all these secrets and so on and so on, who's ever behind this whole thing in the United States government, maybe an organization of the governments of the world? They're allowing that information to come forward because it's either unimportant, not true, or the person's not telling the truth. If there's anything of significance that comes forward, it will be silenced right away.
Right. So, you know, you're on the right track if somebody comes forward and tries to shut you up, eh?
Well, you know, that's probably the case. If you have sensitive information, but if you're just investigating UFOs and so on, and, you know, you're not really considered a threat. I mean, you know, because, you know, sightings happen all the time and they're easily forgotten by people.
Right.
Now, but if you're going to produce something that's going to make a stir, yes, you will be contacted.
Mm.
And, you know, before Night Siege was published, you know, I was contacted by the United States Air Force and the National Security Agency regarding the UFO sightings that were in that book.
Mm.
And they didn't want to start a UFO scare in the Hudson Valley. But the fact is that yes, I mean, you know, they are monitoring, but they, you know, they're not monitoring everybody, but they do listen from time to time and pick up information and try to find out information about it or try to silence it or stop it from hitting the mainstream public, so to speak. And back in 1984, that was pretty easy to do because you have to remember there was really no internet. And there was really no, you know, a lot of satellites conducting a lot of communication. Mm. If the Hudson Valley case and the sighting over the Indian Point nuclear reactor in the Hudson Valley took place today with all of this boom in communication that we have, it would have been had an enormous impact on UFOs across the world.
Right. Photographs.
Back then it was very easy to cover up.
Right. Photographs and the like were taken of these things, right? There was supposed to be ultralights in close formation at night, which is stupid.
Well, you know, that's the... If you're in an important position like the state police or the Air Force or so on, you're going to have to come forward with an explanation so the people quiet down.
Well, sure.
And the thing is that before this UFO was seen over the reactor, it flew over the Brewster area, and it was videotaped in the Brewster area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a copy of that video is probably one of the best nighttime UFOs because the object is enormous on there, but it's lights. You have to remember, back in 1984, video was not as high resolution as it is today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of noise and stuff in it. But working through a person who had connections at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, we were able to send that video to Dr. Lou Allen at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. JPL, by the way, does all the imaging for the space program and is one of the most anti-UFO organizations in the world. As a matter of fact, Lou Allen, the director of JPL, was named as one of the members of the modern-day MJ-12, if that organization really exists. But they had no idea that that video was going to, that analysis was going to come back in our hands. Lou Allen thought it was just an exchange and doing it a favor for a person who he served with in the military. But the analysis of that videotape indicate that they believe that the object in the videotape was one rigid object, and that's, quote, rigid object, which would rule out, by the way, planes in formation.
Right, right. I want to come back to this in just a second, but I need to take a short break to tell our listeners that, remind our listeners, you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves out of Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I am David Twitchell. And we're speaking with author and educator, science educator, Mr. Philip Imbrogno. Now, back to this Hudson Valley thing. Over this power plant, nuclear power plant, there were also alien beings that were seen in the power plant. Is that correct?
Well, that's true. Shortly after the sighting, you know, I made a contact, of course, with people inside the plant. And there were reports, like at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, of these, I guess you could be describe them as the gray-type aliens, the gray skin with the large head and the dark eyes and so on and so on. You know, typical that you see in lunchboxes and pencils now and everything. You know, I mean, you know. You know, coming right through the walls of the reactor with some type of device, moving it up and down the reactor casing. And there was a crack in the reactor casing. And that was discovered shortly after the sightings. Whether or not, you know, the UFO had anything to do with that, or the UFO was attracted to the reactor because of the crack in the casing, I don't know. But one interesting thing took place is that because this happened more than once, the plant was often visited by a person who identified himself as Colonel so-and-so, dressed in, you know, a suit, not military, dressed in a civilian suit, probably was, you know, CIA, NSA, or some other organization. And, you know, you'd always flash his ID in front of the secretary to get in to see the director of the plant. And as he's walking down to the office, the director of the plant comes out and greets him. And they're a little bit down the hall, so the secretary can't hear exactly what they're talking about. But they're out in the hall, and this colonel looked very, very upset. And he's, you know, going through body motions that he's upset. And the director of the plant's kind of like going, you know, what are we going to do about it? And then she hears very clearly, because the colonel lost his temper and yelled at the director of the plant, "I don't care if the are from outer space. Shoot them." So, you know, that's that was quite interesting. That happened, you know, these visits happened more than once. So, you know.
So did they shoot him?
I don't know. But there was a quote, when the object, when the UFO came over the plant, the night of the sighting, the watch commander gave the order to pass out the heavy armament. And they have enough on that plant, because I've seen it, to defend, you know, an attack from a small army. Now, what happened is that next, a few months down the line, I was talking to a newscaster by the name of Jerry Culleton, who used to work at WVIP in Mount Kisco, and he was like he was an evolved newsman. He was like, you know, wanted to find the answers. So he actually got to talk to a fellow by the name of Carl Patrick, who was the spokesman for the plan at the time. And Culleton asked him, I want to know, can you answer the question? Well, they confirmed, Patrick confirmed the sightings, that they had a UFO sighting.
Mm-hmm.
And Culleton asked, well, can you tell me if the guards fired on the object? And the exact words from the quote from the newspaper article, which was entitled, by the way, Did Aliens Buzz Indian Point, said, Carl Patrick's exact quotation said, we cannot confirm or deny if the guards fired on the object, but they did what was necessary to protect the plant.
Mm-hmm. I love that. We cannot confirm nor deny.
Yeah, I mean, that's
no,
saying
if the answer is yes,
know if they fired or not.
Right.
But they're not going to get caught in a lie.
Right. It's like you ask somebody from Area 51 or the Air Force Base in Ohio, are you housing crashed disks or alien bodies? We cannot confirm nor deny.
Yeah, like nobody knows. I mean, give me a break. That's like deniability.
Yeah, that's right.
If it comes out, they can't say that they were lying. They can say, we don't know. It's like all of these people who come to these congressional hearings, and the congressman asks these people a question, and they know the answer, and the lawyer whispers in the ear, and then the person says, you know, I can't remember that phone conversation.
Thank you, Oliver North.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't recall that exact phone, the content of that phone conversation. Right. Of course they do.
Of course. Of course they do. Let's go back to your book now, the most recent one. There's so many things in are covered in here, like Bigfoot and ghosts and you name it. If it's paranormal, it's in this book, Files from the Edge. And I believe there are certain hot spots, not only for UFOs, but for other paranormal things. You mentioned the ley lines in the earth. Is this what, you know, magnetic lines? Explain ley lines for our listeners that may not be familiar with it. And why is it that these are attract paranormal activity?
Yeah, well, you know, ley lines are related to magnetic lines. Nobody really knows what they are. Some scientists say they don't exist, but they don't seem to be able to be measured with scientific instruments. But their effect can be felt on individuals and so on, and animals and so on, and we do see paranormal phenomena there. What I believe they are is that I believe that the universe is multidimensional in nature, and that this magnetic energy that's generated from the core of the Earth through the magnetic poles, just like a bar magnet, these magnetic lines of force generate out through the Earth. These are magnetic lines of force in which we see a lot of interesting things take place on planet Earth. But some of this magnetic energy is also being generated in a multidimensional state. In other words, there's bands of magnetic energy that are not in our dimension but are traveling through like a fourth dimension, a fifth dimension, that, you know, lies close to ours. And I believe these are ley lines. Now, the connection between that and paranormal phenomena is, you know, has been discovered by accident. For example, I believe that much of the paranormal phenomena that we see, including UFOs, actually emanates from a close-by dimension. Most of the UFO phenomena, not all of it. It's a complex thing. But along these magnetic lines that loop and twist around each other, they form portals. So you can imagine this. Imagine a shoestring, a very long shoestring. Now, if that's stretched out straight, that could represent a magnetic line with a ley line in another dimension. But if you take that string and loop it and make a little loop with a hole, you have a magnetic vortex around there, which actually acts as a conduit to another dimension. Here, phenomena in that other dimension, whether it be intelligent or not, can filter into our world And I believe that many of these things go one way, like wormholes. But if you take that string with the loop and pull it tight, that entrance closes. So these magnetic lines of force with these portals open and close, I think, depending upon the extent of the magnetosphere of the Earth. I think when we have a certain amount of solar activity and so on, these loops change, causing these vortexes, these portals, to open up in different areas. And this is why we see a great deal of paranormal phenomena concentrated in certain areas. Also, you have to remember that if you look at Stonehenge, the pyramids, the chambers in the Hudson Valley, the stone chambers, a lot of these ancient mystical sites are located right on these magnetic lines of force. And they weren't put there by accident. They were put there because many of these ancient people, including the Native Americans, believe there are certain locations that connect our world to another reality.
Right. Now, with all the earthquakes and volcanic eruptions and one earthquake that tends to shift the Earth actually on its axis just a fraction of an inch, wouldn't that affect the ley lines as well?
Of course it will.
Our magnetic, those magnetic lines are being affected. The ley lines would be affected as well. Right?
They would to a certain degree. They may cause, they may cause these magnetic lines of force and ley lines to twist more and to more or less get bent out of shape. I'm sure that a lot of these ancient sacred sites, the portal areas have missing lines since they were originally built to mark the locations. And but even like, you know, the earthquake, shifting the earth a little bit, an inch and so on, that's not going to affect it that much. But it could cause pulses or generation of spasms in these lines of force to create more dimensional openings. That's very possible. So this is one of the reasons why, besides other factors, why we're seeing an emergence of paranormal phenomena. And I think it's it goes in cycles anyway. At one time, people reported more encounters with strange beings and lights and creatures and so on. Then it died off for a while, and now it seems to be coming back. So we may be having a reemergence of crossing barriers or overlapping with another reality to change our reality.
Right. Yeah, I've been told that that the veil, what I've heard is the veil between dimensions is getting thinner, and one day it will bleed through, and that other dimension will be part of ours.
And for a while, until it, you know, moves back out. But you have to remember that back in the Middle Ages and a little bit before that time, things like trolls and elves and all kinds of things that they identified. Of course, they couldn't call them aliens and so on and
right,
so on.
Right, right, right.
But, you know, these were common things to people. We read these stories today, and we look at them as mythology and so on and so on. But it seems like to the people of that time, they were real. I mean, they can go in forests and see fairies or trolls and so on and so on. Now,
and the leprechauns would...
And the leprechauns, I mean, they're all related, right?
Yeah.
Leprechauns and so on, and jinn and so on in the Middle East. But they all called them by different names, these dimensional beings.
Right, right.
Then they disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're seeing an emergence of these creatures again. But now, you know, we're starting to call them different things because of our society today and the way we're educated today. We don't look at a lot of these things with supernatural causes. We like to look at them in sort of like aliens and so on like that now.
Well, that would account for some of the UFOs that are witnessed and actually videotaped, where they're right there in front of the camera and they don't seem to take off, but they just vanish, disappear. And maybe they're sliding in and out of this this other dimension.
And they seem to have the ability to do that. And you have to remember that we're three-dimensional beings. We can slide in and out of a two-dimensional world because we encompass all three dimensions. A four-dimensional being may be able to go into all four dimensions. And when it moves back into that fourth-dimensional space, although it would be in the same place, we wouldn't be able to see it.
Right.
I mean, it's an amazing thing to think about that the string theory, called the M theory now, encompasses all of these extra dimensions in space. And that in the room that you're in right now, and I'm in right now, and the listeners are in right now, there may be other beings in there that inhabit the same space but at a different angle, an angle that we can't turn to walk into.
I can just see my listeners looking around the room right now. The guy in the car driving down the road, looking in the passenger seat. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, there's cases where people have been driving and these beings have appeared in the car out of nowhere.
No.
And, you know.
Keep your eyes on the road, folks. Keep your eyes on the road, folks.
Yeah, well, you know, like I say in a book I'm working on now called Portals, which is going to be published in 2011. I say, you know, the multiverse is no privacy in the multiverse.
No. Yeah, it's like spiritual contact and, well, you know.
Well, to us it would be spiritual. It would be like a ghost-like sighting. Even if we could view these beings from time to time, most of the time they would appear like shadows to us. So if these other dimensions do exist, which I believe they do, and, you know, Stephen Hawking believes they do, and all these great physicists and so on, Max Tegmark at MIT and so on, I mean, and these other dimensions are inhabited, I mean, and these creatures, when they come close to the membrane that divides the dimension, they have a more of ability to do so than we do. This could account for a lot of sightings of so-called ghosts.
Right.
And things like that. Shadow people.
Right.
Which are increasing in numbers also. Maybe all of this. See, when we factor in the multidimensional universe into the equation of paranormal phenomena, most paranormal phenomena falls out of the light of superstition and the supernatural, and it becomes more understandable.
Well, now, quantum physics has identified, I think, 11 or 12 different dimensions.
It was 11 dimensions. Yeah, 10 dimensions, and the 11th dimension is the brain, or the fabric in which each dimension is on.
Well, you know, we always were taught when we were kids, there's only three dimensions, and then they threw in the fourth dimension was time, and, you know, if they've discovered these dimensions, and if you're a religious person, you know, there's a heaven or a hell or some kind of a spiritual plane of existence, that's a dimension outside of ours. So why couldn't there be countless dimensions?
Of course, because you're saying it from a different thing. Yes, the concept of heaven and hell and purgatory in the Christian religion, and in the Hindu religion, there are multiple dimensions with multiple universes, each with gods in them and people in them, and if they obey their own rules of physics and so on. So the idea of other dimensions, even in the Druid belief, they believed in a world close by to us, that was the spirit world, the world of spirits, and the Native Americans believed that also. So we see the concept of the multidimensional universe is not a new thing. It's interesting that the philosophers, the mystics, and so on of long ago, it was real to them. They believed in it. They knew it was out there. And the scientists of the 19th and the 20th century said, hogwash, this is all just a bunch of imaginary stuff. Now, with the increases in technology and mathematics, all of these multiple dimensions are starting to show up in the equations of the theoretical physicists. And now they're saying, oh, look at this. We discovered other dimensions. Had these people listened to some of these people of long ago, we may have a better understanding of them today.
Yes. Had they listened to you, then they would have known, right?
Yeah, well, you know.
I've got to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with science educator, author, Mr. Philip Imbrogno. And, yeah, that would also account for things like the Sasquatch, the Bigfoot. You mentioned in your book one case where they followed someone, a witness, followed this giant creature that one could only describe as a Bigfoot. And believe you still have the cast from that. Is that what you said in your book?
Yeah, that's true. That was down in Texas back in the 70s.
Right.
And, you know, that was back in the days when I was a student. I was at the University of Texas, and I heard on the newscast that there were, you know, Bigfoot sightings just outside San Antonio in the Bandera Hills, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, gosh, I got to go up there and check this out. This is like a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Because the news description saying that these creatures, which were described as being 8 to 9 feet tall and enormous hairy things, they would come down from the hills in there, and they would come down and pick up cattle, like a cow.
Mm.
And put the cow on their shoulders and run back up into the hill. So I'm saying, my gosh, this must be super Sasquatch.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I went out there and I went to the Bandera Sheriff's Office. And, I was from New York at the time, you know, and I still had the New York accent. And I'm saying to myself, you know, when I walk into the sheriff's office, you know, they really don't like New Yorkers. So I probably won't get any cooperation. And I walked into the sheriff's office kind of nervous, and the sheriff comes up to me and says, because I already called, they were expecting me, and he says, where are you from, boy? And I said, San Antonio, sir. He says, well, you just come right in here. The deputy over there will take care of you. So
you
they
said
were quite cooperative.
If you said New York, they would have kicked you out.
Oh, if it's in New York, they would have kicked you. Get out of here, you communist. But back then, you know, if you weren't Texan,
right.
So they really didn't cooperate with you. I mean,
you didn't count.
I put on my best Texas accent because I'd been living down in Texas for a couple of years. So I put my best accent, you know.
Yeah.
And I got taken out to the site.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the sites I went to was this rancher who had horses. And he said it was raining one night, and he heard the horses, you know, carrying on like there was a predator. You know, they have mountain lions down there. And so he told his children to stay inside, and he took his gun with a big high-powered light, and he went out there to the barn, and as he's walking, he's raining, and he shines the light, and he sees this creature going up the hill. And he said, you know, he tried to follow it and go up and see what the heck this was. Was it a guy in a suit, or what was going on? But he said it just went up the hill, and then it was gone, like it disappeared. And then the next day, the rain started quieting down, and he went out there, and he found these footprints that went up the hill, and then they stopped. And he was able to take one of the better-preserved footprints and put a box over it, so to keep it. And he showed me, lift up the box, and there was his footprint. And the deputy called in for somebody to come in to make a cast, and they made me one also, which I still have in my study today. But there were quite a few sightings in that area of this creature, but they all indicate that the creature could not have gotten away from them, especially this cattleman who saw this creature put this cow on its shoulders and run up the hill, and he went into his Jeep and went after it. He shot it. The thing brushed off the bullet like a bee stung him and just went over the hill. He went up the hill, and the thing was gone, and the cow was gone.
They never did find the cow or remains of the cow?
Never did find it. Now, this leads into a lot of interesting things because, you know, look at Bigfoot sightings. They're all over the world.
Right.
We had sightings here in Connecticut. I mean, in Connecticut, which is a highly populated area of a creature,
we've
and
had
then
them.
It disappears.
We've had them in Michigan as well.
I know. I mean, But they seem to be like, you know, ghosts. They have the ability to appear and appear very solid, but then they can't be found. It's like, you know, people are saying, well, if they're really out there, why hasn't somebody shot one yet? You know, maybe they don't claim our world as, you know, their home. Maybe they come from somewhere else, and they either have the ability to walk into our world for whatever reason, or they accidentally fall in and, you know, find their way home eventually.
Right. Our laws of physics would dictate that if we shot at one, if these guys in Texas shot at one, our laws of physics dictate that it would penetrate the body, at least knock them down, probably kill them. But perhaps, if what you're saying is true and they're other dimensional beings, perhaps their bodies do not conform to our law of physics. Is that right?
Well, we don't know. You see, this creature, it just brushed, when it got hit by the bullet, it felt it, but it just brushed it off like, you know, a bee sting. And it just looked annoyed and just continued, like, you know,
right.
It looked, you know, like it was upset, and that just, but it didn't phase it.
Right.
It was like it just brushed it away. So, you know, in Files from the Edge, I do cover my, you know, Bigfoot sightings and my Bigfoot investigations.
Right.
And it's all part of the paranormal world, which, you know, in many of the cases I've collected involving what I believe to be dimensional beings.
Right. So it's possible if Bigfoot is another dimensional being, these footprints, this just vanishing along with the cow, would indicate that it just went back into or through this interdimensional veil. Is that correct?
Interdimensional portal of some
portal
sort.
Of
and
some
how else could you explain where there are no tracks, where there should be tracks?
Right.
Quite a few cases that I've investigated. And most people, like, you know, who hunt Bigfoot and want to, you know, go out and look for Bigfoot and so on, monster hunters, you know, they're like under the impression they want to believe that this is a solid physical being that's left over from the Ice Age, an ancestor of humans and so on, that didn't become extinct and so on and so on.
Right.
You know, they stick to that like people who investigate UFOs only want to believe that UFOs represent aliens, extraterrestrials with a high technology from another star system.
Right.
You see, the problem is with people who are investigating this stuff, they're not open-minded to the many possibilities. They stay locked into a theory that feels comfortable for them.
Right, right. Well, it would also explain some of this alien abduction phenomena where they come, the aliens allegedly come through closed windows or walls and levitate the abductee right through the windows or walls. And people say, well, that can't happen. That's against the laws of physics. Once again,
well, it
it's against the laws of physics in this dimension, right?
Well, you have to remember that what we consider the physical world is really not physical at all. There are more spaces between the nucleus of atoms than there is something being solid. The only reason why you're laying on your bed or you're walking on your floor or you're going to your door or your car or something, one reason why you don't go right through your wall is because there are electrostatic forces, electromagnetic forces being generated because the electrons are spinning so fast. So they're spinning so fast in your hand and in the wall, it makes you repel. It bounces you back. You don't really have contact with it. It bounces you off. But if you can change the quantum signature of your hand, you would be able to, and you would be able to pass right through the wall. It's like two radio waves. Two radio waves on the same frequency will collide as if they're solid. But two radio waves on different frequencies will pass through each other like they don't exist.
So it's really not against our laws of physics to pass through a wall.
Not the physics that is the physics of the 21st century, no. Maybe the physics of the early 20th century, yes. But we're learning now that the only reason why things appear solid, it's because the electrons are spinning so fast, they're going around the nucleus so fast that they're creating these forces that repel. Mm. Now think of it this way. Imagine a fan blade, okay?
Mm.
Fan has three blades. When the fan is off, you could put your finger in between the blades. But when the fan is on, it's turning so fast that it appears like one solid piece.
Right, right.
And your finger or whatever you put in there gets bounced back. That's a simple comparison, but basically it's the same thing.
Right, right. Now, you mention the year 2012 in your book. I don't want to get into a long diatribe on this, but what is it you say in your book about what may happen in 2012? What are all these 2012 scares really boil down to?
Well, I really don't know what's going to happen, but I do believe that at 2012, what we call reality is going to be changed because we are merging with these other dimensions, which we haven't done in like over 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
But there are too many things that seem to be happening. For example, in 2012, the sun is reaching the peak of its activity in the sunspot cycle. It's been very quiet now. The sun has to catch up with all that energy. So in 2012 or shortly after that, I think we're going to see an increase in solar activity causing an increase in the solar wind. Also, we are going to be lined up with the galactic core, which there's a giant black hole in there which generates, you know, in a lot of radiation, and it's more or less polarized, directed like from each side, so we're going to be moving right through that direct beam of radiation from the black hole in the galaxy, which we haven't done in like a very long time. Also, as the Earth rotates around the sun, it spins, but as the Earth revolves around the sun, I should say, it rotates, and like a top, it wobbles. And as the top wobbles, when it reaches one cycle, it like almost falls over and then goes back up again.
Mm.
It's like wobbles even more. The Earth goes through this precession every 25,000 years or so, and we seem to be coming to the end of that precession sequence, that wobble. Also, the planet Venus is going to cross the disk of the sun in 2012 twice.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of these astronomical events going to take place. And I really can't believe that it won't have some type of an effect on planet Earth and our society. So it should be quite interesting. I was just up in, you know, Exeter, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
They had the Exeter UFO festival up there, and I spoke up there, and at the end of the conference we had a panel, and quite a few people were coming up and asking about 2012.
Hmm.
And Stanton Friedman was there, Peter Robbins, and a few others, myself, and I was really the only one who would answer the 2012 questions. I believe that the media, the History Channel and a lot of these channels, are hyping it up because it's going to get viewers, and man, you have to remember, I'm an educator, and I know that many young children are watching these shows and starting to get terrified.
Yes.
Of the 2012 doomsday predictions.
I've got a 9-year-old grandson who's paranoid now, and I tell him, don't worry, nothing's going to happen.
But yeah, I tell them, you know, the Mayan calendar meant the end of a cycle, just like our calendar ends in 12 months, and we start a new year. But they have a longer calendar that starts an exact new year.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, it's terrifying a lot of kids. I know one young man who was, you know, who built an altar for himself, and he's praying to God so that he doesn't die in 2012.
Gee. The book is Files from the Edge, A Paranormal Investigator's Exploration into High Strangeness. The author, Philip J. Imbrogno. Where can people go to check this book out?
Well, they can get it at any bookstore, or, you know, Amazon is also a good source to buy books.
Do you have a website?
I don't have a website.
Okay.
But, you know, it's on Amazon. It's in your local bookstores. But I would say, you know, for the people who are involved with UFOs, look for my book in December, which probably would be available. It's available now. It's on Amazon now, Ultra-Terrestrial Contacts. That really focuses on the contact phenomena over the last number of years, 20, 25, 30 years. And I'm anxious to see how the UFO community responds to it.
Right. Philip Imbrogno, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, David.
Okay. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.fm's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.fm, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. And to our loyal listeners, I want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving. And I want to thank you for joining us today. And please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, I'm David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
That's a thumbs up. Okay. All right. My name is Jimmy. This is Floating in a Tin Can. Brought to you by the good people at WHFR Dearborn. 89.3 FM. From the campus of Henry Ford Community College. Or across the web, WHFR.FM. This is the only station making waves. I'm your non-resident spaceman. And I wish you a good day. It is day. There? Yes? Yes. Okay. Oh, wow. Hey, Magic Notebook says that it's election day. Well, given that, well then, hang on 1 second. Yeah, okay, yeah, we can do that. All right. If it's election day, I can throw together a few relevant things. Hang on.